Let's talk to Nikki Segnet. Now, the hugely anticipated follow-up to Nikki's landmark global bestseller, The Flavor Thesaurus, has been released. It's called The Flavor Thesaurus, More Flavors, Plant-Led Pairings, Recipes and Ideas for Cooks. Nikki, you're very welcome to the programme. Good afternoon and thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, Gil. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Delighted to. We were talking about over-consuming alcohol in the first hour of the programme. Now we're talking about food. So you could say there's eating and drinking in the programme today, which is great. Nikki, More Flavours. It's all about plant-led pairings. And in the little brief that I got, I was mentioning kale to cashew, pomegranate to pistachio. That sounds fabulous. You must have had great fun writing this, did you?
For some of the time, yes. I mean, the research can be a little bit less about eating and a bit more about going through lots of dusty books and agricultural papers. But what I'm doing is trying to find the stuff that makes it fun to read. And yes, I suppose that the recipe testing is the good bit.
Mm. And in relation to the research, you said going through journals and going through various books and stuff like that. Do you ever kind of get just an idea into your head that this just might work with this? I remember a couple of years ago, I was doing some cooking and I had some coriander. And I ate some coriander. And then without even thinking, I put my hand into a bowl that had some dry roasted peanuts in it. And I put them in my mouth. And the flavours between the dry roasted peanuts and the herb, it was just phenomenal. So are you like that?
I think if I came across those two, I'd be thinking that's going to taste a bit like some Southeast Asian foods. That's going to have like a satay and coriander flavour. It's going to have a bit of a Vietnamese kind of twist to it. So if you like those kind of foods, those kind of things, that is going to taste good to you.
Mm. And but do you ever kind of get an idea that this and this might just work and then do it, try it?
Absolutely. So there's a couple in the book that, I mean, I suppose I pick up clues as well, because obviously I'm researching, the books are volumes of flavor combinations with a description of like what they're like or if they're, you know, if they're particularly good. And one of the flavors in the new book is maple syrup. And obviously, a lot of the time you're pairing something like maple syrup, it's quite an expensive ingredient to buy.
Yeah.
A lot of things that you put with it kind of dampen down the lovely flavor that it has. But I was reading about it and I got the idea that some fennel seed, just a very small amount of fennel seed, would kind of prick out the kind of make it sort of lighter and really pick out a natural flavor that's already in the syrup. And that was, I made a fantastic tart with those two. That was really beautiful.
Was it a sharp kind of a taste?
Sorry.
Was it sharp? Did it taste sharp?
Well, it tastes more like fresh, you'd say, a fennel seed. So it's got the aniseedy flavour, but it's also kind of, it's not actually menthol, but it almost acts like menthol. So I always think like with something very, very sweet, say even with something like a dried fig or dried fruit, fennel is a bit like opening a window in a hot room, you know, because a lot of things that are dried fruit syrups and things, they're intensely sweet. So you want to just like dampen down that sweetness so it doesn't get too boring for the palate.
Mm. Have you a favourite recipe or a favourite thing to eat?
From this book?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was going to talk to you about a butterbean leek and cauliflower déjeuner, which I really like in this book.
Mm. All right. Do you want to run through that with me?
Yeah, I can do. I'll tell you. So what you need to do is get about 400 grams of cauliflower and cut it up into a florette, you know, sort of the kind that you might make for a cauliflower cheese.
Hmm.
And then you're going to simmer those in boiling water for 6 minutes and then drain them really thoroughly and put them in a 20 centimeter square roasting pan.
Can I stop you? Can I stop you there, Nikki, if you don't mind? Sorry, I've often wondered about this. When you say put it into a square roasting pan, is that important that it's square?
No, but it's important that it's 20 centimetres square, because if it's not that, then you're going to want something with about the same surface area. Okay. So you have to go back to your math.
Okay, so that's what it's for.
See if you can see and get it. That is exactly what it's for. And so you want something approximately that size. I mean, I suppose you just want to make sure you're not getting it too far out, like going with something really big so that it's also spread out in the end that it burns. So 20 centimeters square approximately. And then you dry the saucepan, put it back over a low heat and add a couple of tablespoons of oil. And then in that, you're going to put a finely diced onion and cook that for about 5 minutes, watching it so those little bits don't burn. And then add some leeks, say about 3 leeks sliced, cleaned, and then add those to the onion and give it another 5 minutes. So you've got a nice oniony, leeky mixture. Remove them with a slotted spoon and put that over the cauliflower.
Okay.
And then back with the same saucepan on a low heat, you're going to melt 15 grams of butter and then add 4 teaspoons of flour, a heaped teaspoon of dried mustard powder, a teaspoon of ground coriander, and 1/2 teaspoon of salt. And you mix those over the heat. So you're making a roux here like you're making a white sauce or like you're making a bechamel or something like that.
Right.
And then you're gradually going to whisk in 250 milliliters of vegetable stock or bean stock if you've cooked your own butter beans.
Right.
And 100 milliliters of dry white wine. Bring it to the boil, whisk it, so it's the same as a bechamel. You want to kind of keep whisking it so any lumps disappear. And then simmer it to the point where the sauce isn't kind of runny. You want something that feels a bit more like a thick custard.
Okay.
And then stir a couple of teaspoons of grain mustard and a teaspoon of honey into that. And then take a couple of cans of, we get cans, maybe over where you are you get jars, but you want a couple of jars or cans of butter beans, cooked ones. Pour those over the onion, leeks, and cauliflower that's in your 20-centimeter square roasting pan. And then you're going to take the sauce, gently mix that into all the vegetables with a couple of tablespoons of cream, and then put about 50 grams of breadcrumbs mixed with 50 grams of grated cheddar, and put that into an 180 degrees Celsius or gas mark 4 oven for about 30 minutes. And the top should be golden and bubbling, and serve that with a green salad. And it is an absolutely fantastic vegetarian dinner.
It sounds absolutely beautiful. And something as well that it doesn't take a whole lot of time to put together, sure it doesn't?
It doesn't, no. I think, you know, once you've got your vegetables chopped, it's all really, really quite simple. And, you know, you could always make twice as much of it because it heats up very well the next day.
Lovely. At the moment, you know, purse strings are being tugged very strongly by an awful lot of things. So, you know, are the recipes that are in this book, will they kind of save you a couple of bob maybe?
Well, or the economical? I suppose in a way, you know, it's not a vegetarian book. It's not a vegan book. It's what I call plant-led. So it sort of speaks to people who want to perhaps eat a bit more vegetarian food in their diet, which of course, as a rule, eating vegetables and eating plants is cheaper than eating meat. But the most important thing, and this goes for the Flavor Thesaurus, More Flavors, and the previous Flavor Thesaurus, they're books that encourage you to kind of look up the ingredient in the back, see what, you know, what I'm saying it's going to be nice with, and go off and kind of try things that you haven't tried before. Use up the stuff that's in your fridge and in your larder in interesting ways. Find new ways of eating ingredients that doesn't, you know, that don't cost a lot of money. Things that we have, you know, things that are easy to grow in the garden, like courgettes and green beans, that kind of thing. I think probably one of the best ways of saving money on food is not throwing stuff away because you don't know what to do with it.
I like as well the fact that in the book you say, you know, you combine, or the combinations, you kind of describe them. You talk about one combination being like autumn in the 15th century, not autumn of last year or next year. gooseberry and bay leaf, you said. Bay leaf is gooseberry's publicist. That's fabulous. Where do these images come from?
Oh, well, that comes from my enjoyment of writing, my enjoyment of language, but also the fact that if you're going to write, I mean, the first book has got just under 1,000 flavor combinations. The new one, I think, has 800. Obviously, you can't say the same thing over and over and again. You've got to try and make it interesting. And I suppose for me, what I'm trying to do is sell people the idea of trying these different combinations or thinking about, you know, where do they take you? Do they make you feel like you're on holiday in Greece? Do they make you feel like you're being transported to another time? Do they make you feel like you feel fresh and healthy. So I try to capture some of that in all the entries, just to make it, you know, it's got to be an interesting book to read. It's not just, you know, you're not just looking up the combination. I'm going to tell you something about it. Where does it come from? Mm. When might people eat? And why do people put rhubarb and ginger together? All that kind of stuff. Why do certain flavors go together? That's what I'm trying to get under the skin of, and make it interesting to read. Make it a really kind of, it's, no one's written a book about flavors in this way before. So I just want people to really, you know, learn a lot, but also be entertained while they're reading it.
And with the number of combinations that you discuss and talk about and describe in the book, there have to be some very unusual flavors. Give us a sample of one or two of those.
Well, one that's come up with a new book quite a lot that people are intrigued by is chocolate and aubergine, which is an old, centuries-old combination from Italian cookery.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's that. There's chickpea and prune. Wow. Which may sound quite unusual, yeah. But again, that's that comes from some corners of Europe where they like to put chickpea and prune. We have broad bean and cheese. Now, that might not sound completely unusual, but the broad beans in this case, this is an Italian combination. You eat the broad beans raw.
Ah.
So pick them off the pods, shell them, and then just eat them with a lovely salty goat sheep's cheese, which I'm sure you know, you can get from your good cheese shop.
Mm. It sounds brilliant. Sounds absolutely lovely. When you're putting these together, I know that the book is laid out in such a way as that it gives you the recipes, but it also gives you tasting notes, and it gives us lots of information, doesn't it, Nikki?
Yeah, as I say, it's first and foremost, it's a reference book. It's there, you know, you can look up whatever ingredient you have, and it gives you a big list of what flavors you can pair it with. And then each of those pairings has a page number, so you can turn to the front and read all sorts of things about it. Get completely lost in the subject, or wait until something catches your attention and you think, that's what I want to make. And then you can get in the kitchen and, you know, either try something new or, you know, revisit something that you haven't had for a while that it's just kind of reminded you of.
It's obviously a great book to have, a great reference to have in the kitchen. But is it something you could keep on the sideboard beside the bed, and before you go to bed, you could read a couple of pages of it, enjoy it?
I mean, I do know that quite a few people, I mean, the first book sold about 250,000 copies, and a lot of people use it in the kitchen. But people write to me and say, I read this like a novel. Mm. I read this cover to cover. You know, some people just really, really enjoy reading about food, and it's, you know, it's all kind of little entries. So I think you can start reading a paragraph and think, oh, I'll just have a quick read of this. And then before you know it, you've gone off on a little journey into a whole different world.
Has anybody ever told you that you because of what they read, or a particular combination or a particular recipe, that they had to go foraging far and wide to get the ingredients?
Well, who do you think I am, Otto Lengi? No, not so much. I mean, okay. I think the new book has more unusual ingredients in it. But I suppose when I'm looking at it, there are things that have become a little bit more commonplace in our larder. So things like pomegranate seeds and caraway and some of the more unusual stuff. The first book covers 99 of, if you like, much more commonplace ingredients. But these ones, I think, in the 12 years between the two books, some of the more unusual stuff in the new book has become more commonplace. And I think something like pomegranate is interesting because people buy, you know, either a box of the arils, or they buy a pomegranate and they use some, but they don't use all. Mm. And brings it back to that kind of, okay, I've got half a box of these. What am I going to do with them?
Is there anything you don't eat?
Me, mushrooms. I absolutely loathe them.
Really?
Yeah.
Incredible.
Such a shame.
Indeed. Yeah, because mushrooms can
what
be...
What about you, Gar?
Honey and liver, I can't eat. Honey and liver.
Well, will you read the honey section of this new book and see if I can change your mind?
I absolutely will. I will. I mean, I can take, you know, something, if I'm looking at something and it's got honey in it, as long as honey isn't like the primary taste, or it's not too sweet, because I'm not into sweet things as much. So I can live with that. But as for liver, I tried when I was a child. I tried when I was a teenager. I tried when I became an adult. And no, I just can't do it. It's simple as that.
Is it the taste or the texture? I think it's
the taste. And you know, the interesting thing, I'm a bit of an enigma. I love strong tastes. I really do love strong tastes, but I just cannot handle liver. It's simple as that. So honey and liver.
I think a lot of people have, if you had a bad experience with something when you were a child, that can be quite hard to override. And I think liver is one of those things that was quite badly prepared at school.
Yeah, no, in fairness,
people never get over it.
I grew up in Ireland, so we didn't have school dinners. So the dinners would have been on the table at home. And in fairness, my mum is a fairly good cook. But I didn't have any bad experience. That's the interesting thing. I didn't have a bad experience with it. But I don't know, maybe if I went to some Egon Rone restaurant and they prepared liver for me, they might do it differently. I don't know. But hey, we're not going to try it just in case. I'm too old and too long in the tooth now at this stage. But I will read the honey section, see if it can change my mind. How's that?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, have a read of it. I mean, there are hundreds of different honey.
I will. I certainly will. Listen, it's been lovely talking to you. The name of the book is The Flavor Thesaurus, More Flavors, Plant-Led Pairings, Recipes and Ideas for Cooks. Nikki Segnett, thank you so much indeed for taking time out this afternoon to talk to me about it. I wish you well, and I know that your book is available on our virtual bookstore on our website, which is tre.radio, and that's where our listeners can get their hands on it. All right?
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Delighted.